I do not know whether there is anyone amongst us who is in a position to speak on that subject with authority and definiteness. But we all like to look up to the heavens and sort of imagine or guess what the truth or the beauty there may be like. Perhaps it is just possible for us, out of faint intimations that we might have had now and then, to guess the nature of that beyond, to which obviously the phrase spiritual consciousness or the word spirit relates. Consciousness is something so extraordinary and mysterious that although each one of us is conscious in some way, has a mind which works within certain limits, none of us really knows what it is. Not spirit, it is not matter, but it is something which is capable of knowing both. It stands as a kind of medium or mediator between the two ends or poles of existence. The mind that we normally use is not consciousness in its integrity or in its original nature or as it was in the beginning, if we may talk in terms of time. But it is a consciousness which has been cribbed, cabined and confined, you know that phrase, hedged in, bent in various ways, structured, impacted with various kinds of ideas and substances, made viscous in its texture, opaque, and I do not know what other things have been done to it. That's the consciousness that we have. So when we think of the spiritual consciousness, the divine consciousness and all that, it might seem to us that this is all quite beyond us. We are like insects, let us say. We needn't despise the insects. They are really wonderful, you know. It's also part of a divine manifestation. If I refer to the butterfly, then we might perhaps like to think that we are like butterflies. Able to flit from place to place with rainbow colors and delicate wings and all that. But there is no living organization anywhere on earth which is devoid of mystery, which is devoid of something that will excite our marvel, our wonder, when we come to know about it. You know, they talk of the protoplasm. There is some idea of the protoplasm now through the electron microscope and other means which science has devised. When we look at the protoplasm, we are struck by the fact that it seems to breathe, it moves, it has an organization, and life is at work there in some manner, which carries the construction of that little cell from stage to stage and eventually produces all kinds of marvels that could not have been imagined by any consciousness that just knew the protoplasm and nothing more. Well, there is mystery everywhere. The whole universe in its constitution is so intriguing, so compendious, let me say, of object and subject, the things which you perceive and the significance and the beauty that arises out of the things that you perceive, that it is really not possible for us to float on the surface to plumb its depth and know what it is there, except to a very, very small extent. But there is this small extent, man is really an axis of consciousness which unites the heaven with the earth. And even though the attention may be centered at this lower end. Yet perhaps gradually various other stretches of this thread of consciousness, this electric filament, would come into action, and perhaps we would be able to rise level by level to those wonderful regions to which we like to look up, even in our lowliness. Somewhere HPB says that consciousness is potentially spiritual. That is to say, in its own essential nature, it is not matter, but it is spiritual. How does this consciousness that we find in ourselves and identify with our mind become that spiritual thing, that thing of beauty, of extraordinary delicacy and sensitivity, comprehensiveness? How does it expand into a sky from being this limited thing? Consciousness is neither spirit nor matter, but partakes of the nature of both. We can see how it is like matter. It may be difficult to understand in what ways it is like spirit. It becomes that with which it identifies itself for the moment. If it goes along with matter, it is material. If it is receptive to the spirit, it is spiritual. It can be beautiful, it can be ugly. It can be utterly humble and negative and reflect all the stars that are in heaven within itself. But on the other hand, it may be gross. It may be looking downward. It is an extraordinary thing, but we can understand it when we see how it is related to matter. Matter is a thing of manyness and divisibility. Essentially, from the standpoint of consciousness, matter stands for objectivity, that which is outside you, on which you can look, an object. That is matter. But when you say spirit, it is highly subjective. Who knows where the spirit is or God is or exists, unless you discover it within the tranquil depths of your heart. If you perceive it there and say, I see a wonderful star there, some marvelous blossom coming out of it, well, it's all right. It's an experience to you. But then other people who have not felt it may deny its existence. So it is a truth, it is a mystery, it's a beauty, it's a vastness, which is understandable only within oneself, and within oneself when one is absolutely quiet, when he is able to reflect in the clear waters of his nature, his consciousness, every little feature of the landscape that is about him, the landscape being the universe itself. Theosophy is such a wonderful doctrine when you think of it. Theosophy in itself, not as interpreted by anybody. Of course we say theosophy is what is in the books. Yes, of course. It's represented there. But in itself, it is a certain wisdom. It's a beauty that exists. The artist may try to translate something of that beauty into the canvas or the statue or whatever is the other medium with which he works. But then beauty exists by itself, and it has no localization. It is timeless. It is only for those who have the eyes to see, the heart to respond. I think that all these wonderful aspects of that universal something which we call the spirit, we call it Atma, the monad, and so on, but then we have to try and understand, if we can, what it is essentially in itself. Consciousness is something which we do not understand. The spirit is something which is beyond, which is mysterious, absolutely unamenable to any description. And now we are going to try to understand what is spiritual consciousness. You see, it's very, very difficult. But we can try to understand just a little. Nobody understands the whole of it, and we needn't expect to do that. So we start in a sort of becomingly humble spirit, and then try to understand just some elements about it, what it may be, so that even if we don't know the goal, we at least sort of know the direction in which it lies. I think that's the great advantage of speaking about those things which are beyond. There is some risk in speaking of them, because what man makes out of it becomes a caricature, a travesty of the truth. All spiritual truth, which is so subtle, so delicate, extraordinarily balanced, becomes gross, materialized, and just unrecognizable when it is handled by a mind that is just the product of the differences that we find all around us, the product of the environment. It's not with the mind that has been brought into existence by the environmental factors which will give us a glimpse of the truth, but it is only that pure mind, that thread from the heaven, dropped down from the zenith, which you might call Ariadne's thread. So in order to have some idea of what this spiritual state may be, we have first of all to bring ourselves into the necessary condition to understand it. Without preparation, the preparation of oneself, no one can understand the spiritual truth, because it is not communicable by words. You can just point to it with all kinds of phrases. You can suggest it, the truth, with metaphors. That is why you find that the literature dealing with spiritual things is full of flowery language, all the time poetic, metaphorical, not prosaic. It's not reasoned out. You can't say you take A, which is matter, B, which is consciousness, A plus B makes C, which is the spirit. That's an absurd reasoning. That's not the way in which we can arrive at the nature of that transcendent something, which is the spirit, which is the Atman. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says, I do not remember the exact words, it is a wonder to speak of, a wonder to hear about, a wonder to understand. But after all has been said about it, no one really understands. Something to that effect. I'm sorry, I cannot give you the exact quotation. Well, it is this mysterious something which manifests its nature in the consciousness when that consciousness becomes sufficiently sensitive to recognize it, to respond to that nature, or to realize it within itself. But it has to be brought into that condition of extreme refinement of sensitivity to know what it is. But as I said, all of us have had little touches of its nature now and then. Some moment of love, not in that debased, vulgarized sense in which the word is constantly used in novels and newspapers, not that love which is grasping, possessive, which is just a mass of sensation, mixed perhaps with a little affection, maybe. Not that, it is something which is very different, but some moment when we have not thought of ourselves, but only of the happiness of the other person, without any bargaining, without any hope of return, without wanting anything as a kind of quid pro quo. Well, in some moment of love, pure happiness, not a happiness which is dependent and derived from something, that is just excitement, that is just sensation, but a happiness which wells up from the purity of our nature, like a fountain of living waters. Occasionally we might have experienced that heavenly, devachanic state, even while we are on earth. Or some moment when we have beheld a thing of beauty and had completely lost ourselves, so that we, for the moment, do not exist. Man is his mind or his consciousness. And when then you are not conscious of yourself, you are lost. You say, I am lost in that wonder. Well, it means that for the time being, this self, which is a kind of reservation, which keeps itself all the time on the background and manipulates all kinds of things, which is just going out with a portion of itself to experience, to enjoy, to possess, to hold, cultivate, exploit, and develop. When this self is just lost, dissolved and melted, when it doesn't exist for the moment, you look for the self, no, it's not there. At that moment, the truth manifests itself. So that really to know what the spiritual consciousness holds, the first requisite is a complete dissolution of this I-ness, this me, this strutting self, which is so strident, so insistent, wanting to put itself forward, parade itself on the stage, play a part, impress its beholders, act in all kinds of ways, perform numerous tricks to win the applause of the multitude. This self has to disappear completely as just a thing of mist, a cloud, a phantom, an illusion, before the truth or that divine beauty can reign within our heart. Although we are all the time a kind of cloud of emotion, of various ideas, of reactions which we have acquired and absorbed into ourselves, although we are much of the time this cloud, still there is now and then a break in the cloud and there is a shaft of light which comes through. And just at that moment of clarity or illumination, we know something of what is inside ourselves. And that little knowledge, that intimation, as one might call it, just a touch and it is gone the next moment, and you cannot even recall it. And if you recall it with your memory, it's just a kind of pale reflection of what it was, an anemic reproduction of an image. From that intimation, we can know something of what it is. And it is good to try and know it. That is one part of what we might call our approach to these spiritual things. We have to clarify, purify ourselves, dissipate the mists and the shadows. But on the other hand, you can sort of contemplate such beauty as comes into your consciousness. You can respond to it and try to go into it and understand it, give your attention, your heart to it. When I say beauty, I do not mean merely this physical beauty. You know, beauty in its most comprehensive sense. Beauty of soul, beauty of understanding, the beauty of self-surrender, the beauty of the flower, the stars, the earth, everything, all beauty, which is really beauty and not so-called beauty. Because very often we call a thing which is beautiful because it just pleases us, it excites us a little bit. I do not know whether that is real beauty. From one point of view, the spiritual may be regarded as a refinement of the psychic. That nature which is shot through with emotion, which erupts into thought or bursts into thought. But when you go on refining this psychic, when it becomes subtler and more delicate, purer and purer, then you come to the purely spiritual level. From one point of view, this psychic quality belongs to life and consciousness. But this consciousness, beginning with the material, transforming itself through various stages of the psychic experience or psychic existence, emerges as the purely spiritual. That is one way of putting it. There are many, many ways of expressing the truths connected with the spiritual life. It has been said, and this is a remarkable statement and very difficult to understand, that the spiritual consciousness is in a state of perpetual revolution. Seems a revolutionary statement to make. What can this perpetual revolution mean? What is revolution to start with? Is it just a clash of forces, bloodshed, violence? A revolution consists in bringing into existence an absolutely new order, a new condition, a new state. That is revolution. Everything else is incidental. But that revolution which takes place in man and which brings him to the truth is not a revolution of violence, but it is a revolution in the profoundest peace. When winter gives way to spring, and when you find that all nature is transformed, there is life everywhere, growth, vitality, music in the very air, is that revolution or not? Of course it is the most wonderful revolution that we can find. And of course there are various other phenomena in nature which seem, as it were, completely to transform the previous state. If there are such transformations possible in outside material nature, is not something like it, or even more wonderful than all that, cannot something like that take place in the heart of man? The possibilities within ourselves are much greater than the possibilities that you find in the external world. You may invent all kinds of electronic machines and discover various possibilities and so on. Yes, it is all wonderful. It shows the mysteriousness of nature. We had not understand the forces that it had concealed, that she had concealed within her bosom, which she had kept, as it were, in sealed containers which could not be broken open. Yes, all that, but then the wonders that are within man, the glory of the subjective universe within himself, the possibilities of his thought and imagination, what he can compass within himself and understand within himself, realize, ought to be, I think, a million times more wonderful than anything that you can find in physical nature. Because as you go beyond the physical, it extends boundlessly on every side, so that when you come to that lofty level, which is spoken of as the spiritual sky or akasha, to use the Sanskrit term, it just sort of goes quite beyond human imagination. And to say that is not saying very much, because really our imagination doesn't extend very far. We delude ourselves into thinking that we can think of infinity. We cannot think of infinity. Nor can we think of nothingness. Can you think of nothing? You cannot. You have various images in your mind, as Bergson has pointed out, and you just eliminate these images and you think you come to nothing. But you cannot think nothing. So really our capabilities, whether in the vast or the minute, are extremely limited, more limited than we know. The extraordinary part of it is that we are not really conscious of our ignorance. He is wise who knows he is ignorant. Knows, not just says it. Not say I am ignorant. That statement has no worth. But if you know it in your own hearts, how limited is your capacity, how liable you are to self-deception, how little understanding you possess, then it means that you have some sense or some kind of a scent of the vastness, the beauty that exists around us. So the beginning of wisdom is really lies in a realization, a profound realization of one's own ignorance and limitations. This is really coming down to brass tacks, as you might say, coming down to the absolutely practical ground. We all think too much of ourselves, too much of our capacity. And if a man is clever, if he can speak fluently, well, he is more liable to be conceited to inflate himself and indulge in all kinds of delusions about his own capacity and understanding than other people who are just blind in their simple ignorance. The first step in understanding the nature of the spiritual consciousness is to know one's own limitations. And the greatest of all limitations is caused by the fact that the present is knit all the time to the past. Of course, it has to be knit to the past in a certain sense. The whole panorama of evolution, existence from the beginning of time to the end, is a kind of unrolling film, is it not, in which there is sequence, there is order, there is logic, there is cause and effect. There is a continuous chain, there is an unbroken continuity in the course of things. But when you come to the spiritual nature, it is entirely different. Because when you proceed from the past to the present, you are looking at the present through the past. You are looking at some new idea through the old ideas which have been implanted in your mind and have become hardened in the course of time. It is through a weather-beaten mind that we try to understand the freshness and the newness of the present. In other words, to put it in a simple way, our mind always works through ideas generated in the past. Certain forces have been set in motion already, and those forces are operating. And it is by means of these forces, guided by them, under their control, that we approach the events of the present, the new ideas, whatever may be new to us. That is the case with all of us. But then one has to realize it. Now, how, in what way is the mind attached to the past while it is in the present? We have had some experience. We have enjoyed that experience. And in the moment of that enjoyment, we have in some way formed an attachment to it. And therefore, we become attached to that experience. We become attached to the ideas which represent that experience. And all these ideas are present in our minds. We want comfort. We want sensation. We want excitement. We want some kind of gratification. And therefore, all those things which have given us gratification, satisfaction, sensation, excitement, comfort even, have caused ideas to spring up in our minds, which ideas are permanently there. So that this consciousness, which is such an extraordinary thing and so fluidic, so plastic, which is just like pure clear water, that should be able to flow without the slightest difficulty, becomes, as it were, thick with those ideas, all kinds of ideas that we have in our minds. I should have this. I want that. This is what I approve of. This belongs to me. That is my responsibility. I am more important, and so on, so and so on and so forth. Not merely ideas about religion and philosophy. All the ideas in man are in some extraordinary way related to one another. Your religion and your philosophy will be according to your temperament, according to your nature. You will find in the religious ideas just what you seek. You seek something, well, if there is a set of ideas that gives you that satisfaction, then you just accept it, whether it is the Baptist church or any other church or Buddhist church or whatever it may be. It doesn't matter what. The important thing is to be satisfied. He who satisfies you, or she who satisfies you, or the thing which satisfies you, the idea which gives you gratification, which in some way ministers to your self-conceit, which makes you, as it were, stand up well in your own estimation, that is supremely acceptable, and we just go in for it. But we go in for it in a kind of unawareness. This is really our attachment to the past. It's no use really talking in abstract terms. Past, present, future, eternal, spirit, grand terms. But then they all become abstractions. We don't know what they are. We just sort of terms, that is all. The spirit is an abstraction until it is brought down into the region of one's own consciousness and experience. So in the same way, we mustn't simply talk of past and present and causation and all that becomes very mental. Mental means superficial, you know. Whatever is purely mental is just superficial, because the mind is concerned only with the surface of things. It doesn't go behind the surface, even if it be an electron. Because after all, the electron is either a conjecture or it's an appearance on some screen. That is all. It is just an objective spot. Either a spot on the screen or a spot on the screen of your consciousness. So that all that you know about the electron is just that spot, and then the various associations. You have a certain picture in which it plays an important part. It goes round and round and performs various things, and even delivers the hydrogen bomb. It does all kinds of things like that. But still, even that is merely objective. You are looking at the surface. Unless you penetrate the crust of matter and go down to those waters of life which are there, and then sinking deeper into those waters, you come to the pure nature of consciousness. And what you can behold there, you do not know the mysteries of nature. You do not know its profound depths, which are really inconceivable by an imagination which is merely acquainted with the surface nature of things. So when we say the past, we must bring it down to practical terms. I had something yesterday. It was very pleasant and agreeable to me, and therefore I am attached to it. And I have developed this idea that I must have it again. It's a certain idea in my mind which operates. And there is not only this idea, I have innumerable other ideas. They are all stuck in my mind. When I come to think of a subject, the same ideas crop up. So they are, as it were, sort of permanent particles floating in the waters of my consciousness. So the whole consciousness is really viscous instead of, you know, free and flowing. It is no longer crystalline, it becomes opaque. And gradually, in course of time, it becomes solidified. It even becomes petrified. I become like a rock, like a flint. No one can make a dent upon my mind. You can argue as much as you like, or you plead on your knees. Nothing is going to affect me. I am just this kind of petrified thing. It's more petrified than any coal or anything else that you may find in nature. Don't you find that the consciousness turns itself into that? It is an extraordinary thing how a thing that is so subtle sometimes, so fine, so airy and almost etheric, which you cannot follow in its movement, such a thing becomes just like stone, you know, so opaque, so dull, so static, so firm in its convictions, in its self-righteousness, in what it wants and demands. It has undergone a terrible transformation. That's the wonder of this thing which we call consciousness. It extends from one shore to the other, from the shore of eternity to the shore of time. It is an ocean in itself. There are so many levels of consciousness which, like, you know, those sections of an accordion, let me say, sort of has these two sides. One is the spiritual nature, and the other is the material nature. And the whole wind of it, the force of it, pressure of it, it blows through these sections. Well, that's again a simile, you know. You have to talk in terms of so many similes. Well, the present mentality, what I am just now, is really a product of the experiences which I have undergone in the past. My upbringing, the various influences, the associates that I have had, the particular vocation which I took up, the various family people with whom I consorted, and various other people of my choice, and the newspapers, of course, which have an important part, and all the books that I have read, all these together have, as it were, produced a certain mentality, a kind of amalgam. It has structured my mind so that I am what I am. Now you can see that the individual loses his freedom completely, the mind, the consciousness is not free and flowing. It doesn't have that pliability to which Brother Sidney Cook referred yesterday. Pliability of heart, pliability of mind, which doesn't mean that you turn in any direction, that you listen to any whisper that may come to you, that you absorb all influences, lie in any kind of bed and sweep up the magnetism which exists there. It doesn't mean that. The spiritual man, on the other hand, is a man who, because of his very freedom, because he has a state of great intelligence, because he is aware of what is taking place, therefore he remains uninfluenced. He doesn't succumb to the solicitations of the material things and conditions. He is not influenced by other people, because we are always influenced in a certain part of our nature which finds that influence agreeable to itself. So that when you have broken away from attachment to gratification of any sort, then you are really free in the truest sense of the term, and inwardly you are alone and uninfluenced. Yet on the other hand, because you do not have this notion of self, which is a subject with many predicates, the subject being I, the predicate being want, but I want so many things. Perhaps the objects are many. The predicate is just two or three, I want, I possess, and so on, just two or three predicates. The subject is just one, I, me, and then all the objects which are around the world. You know, that is how human life stands. But when a person has, in that way, understood himself, and through a really deep and quiet and pure understanding, it has to be an understanding without self. It is only in a state of real humility, a complete negation of oneself, that you can really understand. Till then you can have understanding, some understanding, but the real understanding, the true knowledge, the experience of things comes from a negation of self. That's the whole burden and theme of the spiritual life. Not by saying myself is bad. You have pronounced an opinion upon yourself. That's no good. But, you know, that means that there is a kind of pure negativity, a complete lack of self-assertion. So that you are really open, you are really receptive. You are in that state in which a man who is musically inclined listens to the most wonderful music that has ever been played. Exaltedly spiritual. It's quite out of this earth. It just sort of takes you into the dreamland. Let us suppose there is that kind of music. Well, what would you do? You can't sit there and pass judgment thinking how the man swings his baton and how he does that. Yes, that note is right. I heard it before. The construction is right, it seems to be this thing or that thing. Then you go on indulging in all kinds of mental comment and passing judgments about it, or even on trying to understand the construction of the music, you completely miss its beauty. In order to understand anything in its purity, in its real nature, you have to be absolutely quiet and just sort of surrender, yield yourself to the thing, standing alone. Yet yielding yourself, surrendering yourself, being with anybody and everybody, that is the true spiritual nature. You are able to be with anybody and everybody because you do not seek your own. A man who has been able to come to a state of selflessness, who is not really seeking anything at all, not even flattery or the applause of the audience, well, when you don't seek anything, what is your relationship with other people? It can only be a relationship of love. Either you have no relationship at all, which is a state of indifference, a state of isolation, a state of pride and conceit, a state of being satisfied with your own comfort and sensations and what you are enjoying, and which is afraid to be disturbed. Either it is that, or it is just a state in which you are with the other person, seeking nothing. And when you seek nothing, then, of course, there is the real state of love. Love is something which is divine, we say. And what is divine, it cannot really be brought about by man. You cannot sort of force yourself to love somebody. It's impossible. You can think you love, which is, of course, a self-deception. But then this love springs up in the course of things. There is life, there is consciousness, there is love. It is all a certain flow from a divine source. It comes by itself. It will come when there is no impediment. And the greatest impediment of all is self-seeking in so many different ways, or some kind of a self-conceit, this separation or separateness from others. I am holier than thou, or more cleverer than thou, I have more understanding. Sort of looking at people from some kind of a top, you know, pedestal, platform. So when the person is free from attachment to the sensations that he has enjoyed, the gratification that he has experienced, whether through holding a position of importance or having power, control over many things, many people with money have control, or flattery, everybody saying how clever you are, you delivered a wonderful speech this morning, that kind of thing, then whatever it may be, it is just a gratification which bolsters up one's self-conceit. And that, I think, is the kind of upstart in your heart. It starts up, you see, like that, and stands up and holds its ground. Well, it is the upper which prevents the contents of the spiritual nature from flowing out in a natural way. We are all like bottles or sacks with so many ideas that we just hold in them, and the sack is tightly tied at the mouth. So that everyone is really a sack of ideas, a bottle which has all kinds of contents within it, emotional contents, feeling contents, all kinds of contents in it, and it is completely closed. We will admit what we want now and then when somebody brings it. Isn't that really the state in which we are? It doesn't sound flattering to us, but you know, there is some truth in it. It may not be the entire truth. All these similes, they don't run on all fours or all twelves or all hundreds or whatever they may be. They are true up to an extent. They are true up to an extent. You just take the sense out of it, how far it will apply. And don't absorb anything that anybody says, simply because he says it in a clever manner. That is very, very important. Not, as it were, to be carried away by oratory, by flowery, eloquent speech, by all kinds of spacious ideas plausibly presented in gaudy colors. Now, you know, we are all like children. Children like toys, so do we, but we have other toys. We want motor cars, for instance. We are not satisfied with the little dolls that children play with. We have our own toys, you see, but if we have understanding, if we have a certain awareness of what is taking place in ourselves, then we don't lend ourselves to these traps, you know, we don't fall into these little pitfalls. We are no longer children because we are aware. When you have, as it were, broken away, cleared yourself of this attachment, it's a process. It takes some little time. You have to watch yourself. You have gradually to, as it were, to rise out of it, you know, like a thin mist which might rise out of the ground. So your understanding just rises above these things. And when you have, as it were, cleared all these obstacles, then the present, which is not, as it were, worked by the past, your mind, which does not have a belt with something else, so that the other thing works your mind, then it is ever new, it is ever fresh. Suppose a person falls in love all at once, not gradually. You know, when you fall in love gradually, sometimes certain elements of one's emotional and passional nature come into play, and then they produce a certain attraction, they work upon the mind, and then we call it love. But suppose it is just love at first sight, as they say. Now, and in that love, it must be a pure kind of love, because there has been no time in it for the passion to manifest itself or to come into play. You see somebody, you see something very beautiful in him, you like him. If you don't want to use the word love, you use anything else you like. Now, in that condition of mind, which is just the pure condition, which has not yet had time to be affected by various influences that are generated out of contact at different levels, in that condition you see something extraordinary in the person, some charm, some grace, something quite divine. This is an experience which all people who have been in love know very well. They see for the time being the object of love in a somewhat idealized character. They see him in beautiful lines. He is outlined in light for the time being. Every movement of the body seems to be graceful. Well, you see a certain beauty which you yourself don't see afterwards. Because the vision has been dimmed, you have fallen from that state of grace. You are no longer in that state of original purity and newness in which you are able to respond to something new, something bright, without its all other elements of your nature entering into that perception and modifying the nature of that perception. Now that, when you see something beautiful like that, you do not see it afterwards. What is the matter with you? Why don't you see it afterwards? Well, it's due to the mind, that is all. Your mind is different. Therefore, you do not see the same beauty. It's the same with a piece of music. You hear something, it's hauntingly beautiful. You think it's so wonderful that you can listen to it for the rest of your life. You listen next time, it's almost as wonderful. Listen a few times, yes, it's very good. And you listen afterwards, that's a good piece. It has become a conventionalized and established judgment. And you play it afterwards, you say, that's no good. I've heard it so many times, I would like to hear something else. Well, the change is not in the melody. If you had that original consciousness and you brought it to the music, you will feel the same beauty in it, the same heavenliness, but it doesn't have the same appeal because you have become different. In some way you have deteriorated so far as the music is concerned. It has not become stale, you have become stale. So that you see that our consciousness, because of various changes which are introduced into it, it comes down from its high estate. It falls into a condition of commonplaceness in which it misses the newness of things. It doesn't see what is there. So the spiritual consciousness, if it is really a consciousness in which the present is free from the shadow of the past or the trammels of the past, and the attachment is always through desire of various sorts, then it is perpetually new. It sees the beauty, the loveliness which is in everything. And every moment it just sort of is a moment in which, as though it has been newly born and comes to the whole thing anew. You know how, when we are children, everything looks new. The whole world is bathed in a certain light which has passed away since then. After death, for instance, there is a complete renewal. And that's the wonderful part of death. It's very nice to die because you are new. I don't know whether people think of death in that way. Well, it's the death of the body. If you believe that there is a consciousness indwelling, using the body as an instrument, which is moored to some kind of spiritual center, then it exists apart from the body. And when it is detached from the body and freed from its heaviness with all the influences that belong to the bodily sensations, then it gradually recovers its own original nature, and therefore it becomes fresh and pure, it becomes renovated. That is really the meaning of reincarnation. It is a self-renewal every time, but we are unable, unfortunately, to keep that renewed condition, that childlike nature, that purity, that sweetness that belongs to children. Belongs to any young thing. You look at a little lamb or rabbit or whatever it may be, don't you feel that you often say, how sweet it is. In what way is it sweet? It's just a rabbit. But why do you think it is sweet? Well, it is sweet because it is so innocent. It lacks self-defense. It is not justifying itself. It seems to be at the mercy of things. And so such a thing somehow moves us from the bottom of our heart. We are moved by it. So it's not a mere rabbit. It's something wonderful that exists. And when you feel moved by its sweetness, by its innocence, by its tenderness, you are responding to that phenomenon in the right way. You know it. Knowledge is not merely through mind, but it is much more through the heart. Unless you love some person, in a real sense, you really do not know him. At least you must have a certain affection for him, a feeling of goodwill, a sympathy and understanding. Otherwise, you stand apart from him and just pass judgments on him. You never understand him. just the external, the shell upon which you are passing judgments. You have not penetrated to the core. And you find that in all the noblest flights of philosophy and literature, there is always an appeal to something profound in the heart of man. Not only is there an illustration of a superior intelligence which seems to take a mass of experience and sum it up in a few words, as Shakespeare does so often, but there is also a certain appeal to the heart of man. There is the statement of a certain truth which is universal, which always applies, which goes to the heart of each person. So, the spiritual nature is that nature which is our original nature, which is uncontaminated, in which the intelligence is able to understand everything in its true significance, in its depth, so that this consciousness which extends, as it were, from the spirit to matter, and matter is merely a limitation of consciousness when you come to think of it. And this matter, or what you find in the material world, holds in itself a certain significance, a certain meaning, a certain beauty, which you perceive. And when you are able to perceive it, well, it's a ray of that spiritual consciousness at work. The spiritual consciousness is, as it were, perpetually new, eternally young, ever free, unmodified, unconditioned. Yet at the same time, it recognizes its unity with all. It's capable of understanding everything, however limited, however conditioned, however bad it may appear. It's a kind of universally penetrating consciousness which spreads itself on all sides and therefore knows all. It has been said that the spiritual consciousness is one which has its center everywhere and circumference nowhere. Well, the center, in the center is first of all to start with and all the other people who are around you. That's to say, you enter into their nature, into their minds and hearts. You are with them, that is all. We are not with them at present because each one is, as it were, surrounded by a certain wall. And what is within it is his. These are my ideas, they are my opinions. I have certain possessions, I have certain responsibilities to discharge. Let no one take them away from me. You see, I have my affections, these are the people whom I like. All kinds of ways in which this me and mine comes into play, and in that way it tries to create a domain round itself which is really an imprisonment and an enclosure. And when the consciousness is able to rise above that domain, realizing that it is really a prison house, even though it may be a kind of delectable garden in which it walks, yet is a prison house, then of course the consciousness is free. Then it has a different alignment. It has a different gravitation. It gravitates towards its own source. It as it were, is one with its original nature. It is in its native state. It is without any kind of tension, no distortion. It is just a pure continuum, an expanse, which sees things as they are, and not in a wishful manner. Well, it's a beautiful consciousness, is it not? Now, if we try to understand the spiritual consciousness in this way, well, at least we know what is meant by spiritual living. It's not a question of being religious in the ordinary sense of the term. There may be a spiritual man who has no use for religion, or he may be religious for some reason. But then it's the religion of the heart. That is what it is. There is some great truth in religion, because religion recommends virtue, does it not? A pure behavior, a regulated behavior, a beautiful way of relating oneself to other people. So long as religion is on the side of unselfishness, of philanthropy, of charity, of goodness and so on, religion is right. But then you may have all kinds of institutions and paraphernalia, all kinds of dogmas and ideas, authorities to which you have to obey. There is the totalitarianism of religion, along with the totalitarianism of various states, you see. But then to submit to that totalitarianism is really a suppression of oneself. So one has to be free in every way inwardly. That true freedom is also purity, because you are free from every taint of self-indulgence, every taint of self-seeking, purity, freedom, detachment, all these terms become interchangeable in the spiritual life. They represent different aspects of the spiritual nature, different ways in which it shows itself. But the spiritual nature is one which, as it were, has blossomed anew from the roots. And the mind of the spiritual man is a mind which is not conforming to something external to itself, but all the time bringing out something of significance, of beauty, from within itself, from that subjective nature, which, as I said in the beginning, is as vast or vaster than the exterior material nature. It's the universe of significance, it's a universe of truth in the highest sense, the universe of meaning, of ideas, not ideas which are merely the product of our own personal reactions, but ideas which are representative of the truth. So the spiritual nature is creative, because its very nature is creation. The spirit is creative spirit, the Holy Spirit. And it is supposed to have brought all this universe into existence. Well, that spirit is also in us. There is that divine spark, and it can be creative. We often think that only the few great people are original. We cannot be. Unfortunately, we have just to take whatever we want to know at second hand. I do not think so. I think there is in every person the germ of originality, the Atman, the spiritual self, the eternal being is ever original, because he initiates everything from within himself. When you are not affected by the surrounding influences, when you are not seeking to conform to anything, then what you produce must be from within yourself. It is original, it is creative. You cannot help it. So the fountain arises from within. So the spiritual consciousness is something so extraordinarily wonderful that we can try to understand it in all these ways. Anyhow, we can begin in a simple way and try to understand what it can be according to our the possibilities. There is consciousness. Man is self-conscious. He is selfish, self-centered. He has in some way to understand that this is a limitation. When he understands it, the consciousness is free. And when it is free, then it is the spiritual consciousness.